Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, we feature advances in targeted therapy for HER2 mutant lung cancer, interventions to reduce maternal infection, an emerging treatment for hemophilia A, and a new diagnostic test for tuberculosis. We review Barrett's esophagus and follow a case of systemic illness with kidney failure. Perspectives address GLP-1 drugs and eating disorders, directed blood donation, generic drug safety, and an in-flight medical emergency. First lines on zongertinib in advanced HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer by John Heimach from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, Houston, and co-authors. Mutations with human epidermal growth factor receptor 2, HER2, occur in approximately 2 to 4% of non-small cell lung cancers. Zongertinib is an oral, irreversible tyrosine kinase inhibitor that selectively inhibits HER2 while sparing wild-type epidermal growth factor receptor, EGFR, thereby minimizing associated toxic effects. This phase 1A-1B multi-cohort trial assessed zongertinib in 74 previously untreated patients with advanced or metastatic non-squamous HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer. Zongertinib showed sustained efficacy in these previously untreated patients. Treatment-related adverse events were predominantly low-grade. David Carbone from The Ohio State University, Columbus, writes in an editorial that chemotherapy has remained the recommended and most effective first-line therapy for HER2 mutant tumors, until now. Zongertinib received accelerated FDA approval for first-line therapy in February 2026 and will certainly now become the standard first-line therapy for HER2 tyrosine kinase domain mutant lung cancer, as osimertinib is for tumors with its older relative, EGFR. Many questions remain, of course, and we can expect rapid advancements in this field in the coming years. The development and FDA approval of effective first-line oral agents that are active against HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer and that have an acceptable safety profile is a major and clinically important advance, giving alternatives and hope to patients with this important subset of lung cancers. A multi-component intervention to improve maternal infection outcomes by David Lissauer from the University of Liverpool, Liverpool Women's Hospital, United Kingdom, and co-authors. Maternal infection and sepsis are major causes of maternal death and severe illness worldwide, particularly in low- and middle-income countries. This cluster-randomized trial assessed a multi-component intervention, the Active Prevention and Treatment of Maternal Sepsis, APT Sepsis program, which was designed to support healthcare providers in achieving three goals: adherence to World Health Organization hand hygiene standards, adoption of evidence-based practices for maternal infection prevention and management, and early detection of sepsis and the use of the FAST-M, fluids, antibiotics, source control, transfer if required, and monitoring treatment bundle. Usual care was provided in the control group, along with dissemination of guidelines. 59 health facilities where more than 431,000 women gave birth during the trial in Malawi and Uganda were randomly assigned to the intervention group or the usual care group. Implementation of the APT sepsis program led to a significantly lower risk of a composite of infection-related maternal death, infection-related near-miss event, or severe infection-related illness than usual care. In an editorial, James Berkeley from the Center for Graphic Medicine Research, Kilifi, Kenya, writes that overall, the trial showed that systematic attention to basic risk assessment, infection prevention, and early treatment without introducing new technologies or different antibiotic regimens can substantially reduce the risk of maternal infection and its associated complications in low- and middle-income countries. These findings highlight the critical need to refocus on delivering simple health care with quality at scale. The results of this trial support the suggestion derived from modeling in low- and middle-income countries that addressing the quality gap could produce substantial benefits at current levels of access or utilization. Rolling out such a program would require that staff and managers prioritize doing the basics well and identify and direct resources toward patients at greatest risk for death. Although this approach would be challenging in underfunded and overstretched health systems, this trial clearly showed that it is possible with effective leadership. The trial provides a call to action to health systems in countries with ongoing high maternal mortality to focus on adhering to a high and measured standard with regard to training and supporting leaders and implementing core evidence-based practices related to hand hygiene and infection screening and management. MIM-8 bispecific antibody prophylaxis in hemophilia A, with or without inhibitors, by Maria Elisa Mancuso from the Humanitas University Pieve Emanuele, Milan, Italy, and co-authors. MIM-8, denesimig, a bispecific antibody mimicking activated factor VIII, was developed for bleeding prophylaxis in patients with hemophilia A with or without factor VIII inhibitors. This phase 3 trial investigated the efficacy and safety of subcutaneous MIM-8 prophylaxis administered once weekly or once monthly in patients 12 years of age or older with hemophilia A of any severity with or without factor VIII inhibitors. 58 patients who had been receiving on-demand treatment were randomly assigned to continue their therapy or receive MIM-8 weekly or monthly. 196 patients who had previously received clotting factor concentrates were randomly assigned to weekly or monthly MIM-8. During 26 weeks of treatment, MIM-8 prophylaxis was superior to on-demand treatment and clotting factor concentrate prophylaxis regarding the annualized rate of treated bleeding events. In a Science Behind the Study editorial, Alok Srivastava from St. John's National Academy of Health Sciences, Bengaluru, India, writes that the results of the study by Mancuso and co-authors support the primary objective to confirm the efficacy of MIM-8 for bleeding prevention. The pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic data from this trial and their correlation with the risk of clinically meaningful bleeding are eagerly awaited. Only then can the value of the weight range-based fixed dose of MIM-8 be fully assessed. Data on the concomitant use of activated prothrombin complex concentrates for the management of breakthrough bleeding in patients with inhibitors who were treated only with the recombinant factor 7A in the trial by Mancuso et al. Would also be of interest, as would a test of MIM-8 in the management of hemostasis during major surgeries. Regardless, it is clear from the results reported by Mancuso et al. That the new factor 8A mimetic, MIM-8, will increase therapeutic options for patients with hemophilia A. Pulmonary tuberculosis detection with Minidoc MTB using swab samples by Seda Yerlikaya from the Heidelberg University Hospital, Germany. Improved diagnostic tools for tuberculosis that are suitable for use in local community-based health centers are essential for reducing the persistent gap between estimated and notified cases. The diagnostic accuracy and usability of the Minidoc MTB test for detecting pulmonary tuberculosis was evaluated in this study conducted at outpatient centers in India, Nigeria, the Philippines, South Africa, Uganda, Vietnam, and Zambia. Diagnostic performance was assessed against a microbiologic reference standard and as compared with sputum smear microscopy and sputum testing with a PCR assay, Expert MTB RIF Ultra. Usability was assessed by healthcare workers who were involved in routine sample collection and tuberculosis testing at participating sites. Among the 1,380 participants, 18.5% had HIV infection and 16.4% had culture-confirmed TB. Minidoc MTB sensitivity was 85.7% with sputum and 79.6% with tongue swabs. Specificity was greater than 97.5% for both. The test showed diagnostic accuracy that was consistent with World Health Organization accuracy targets for near point-of-care tuberculosis diagnostics. Barrett's Esophagus, a review article by Rebecca Fitzgerald, from the University of Cambridge, United Kingdom. Barrett's esophagus develops as a result of chronic acid and bile reflux and carries an increased risk of esophageal adenocarcinoma. Because it has no specific symptoms, many patients do not receive a diagnosis, or they present with symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux disease and other related risk factors or complications. Diagnosis relies on endoscopic and histopathological findings, including a visible columnar cell line segment measuring at least 1 centimeter long that contains intestinal metaplasia with goblet cells. The identification and treatment of Barrett's esophagus is important because of its associated increased risk of esophageal adenocarcinoma and the potential to decrease the risk of that occurrence. Ongoing surveillance focuses on the early detection of malignant progression, particularly high-grade dysplasia and early-stage cancer, which allows curative endoscopic treatment and avoids the adverse effects associated with chemotherapy or esophagectomy. A 76-year-old woman with fatigue, rash, and kidney failure. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Frank Cortazar and colleagues. A 76-year-old woman presented with a year of waxing and waning purpuric rash on her legs, initially thought to be skin-limited vasculitis. Weeks before admission, the rash returned, now accompanied by fatigue, joint pains, and swelling. Soon after, she developed confusion and difficulty speaking, and was found to have a small stroke. At the same time, her kidney function deteriorated rapidly, with blood and heavy protein in the urine, progressing to kidney failure requiring dialysis. The combination of rash, neurologic symptoms, and rapidly progressive kidney injury raised concern for systemic vasculitis. Low complement levels, an elevated rheumatoid factor, and a monoclonal IgM protein pointed toward cryoglobulinemia. Kidney biopsy confirmed immune complex glomerulonephritis, and bone marrow studies revealed an underlying B-cell lymphoproliferative disorder. The diagnosis was type 2 cryoglobulinemic vasculitis with glomerulonephritis, ultimately linked to lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma. GLP-1 receptor agonists and eating disorders, cause for concern. A perspective by Amanda Banks, from Banks Advisory, Philadelphia. Constraining the growth of the global obesity epidemic would have clear benefits at the individual and population levels. The use of GLP-1 drugs has been linked in some patients to improved cardiovascular outcomes and other benefits. Yet some worrisome signals have emerged as people increasingly use these agents to achieve and maintain slimness in the absence of obesity. GLP-1 receptor agonists have shown early potential as a treatment for binge eating disorder, but there is compelling preliminary evidence suggesting that the use of these drugs could exacerbate and lead to new diagnoses of restrictive eating disorders, including anorexia nervosa. In a large sample of de-identified health records of people taking GLP-1 receptor agonists, patients with a pre-existing mental health condition were more than twice as likely to develop an eating disorder within 2 years after starting treatment than those without such a condition. The cumulative incidence was 1.275%, translating to more than 420,000 people. There is no standard eating disorder screening protocol, and many patients may be taking these drugs without their clinician's knowledge. Legislating medicine, directed donation, and the politics of patient choice. A perspective by Jeremy Jacobs from the Vanderbilt University Medical Center, Nashville. In February, members of the Tennessee General Assembly introduced House Bill 2166, HB 2166, an act to amend Tennessee Code Annotated Title 68, Chapter 32, relative to blood donations, which would require blood banks and hospitals to comply with directed donation requests for patients scheduled for medical procedures. Its sponsors framed the bill as protecting patient choice by ensuring that patients have the right to select what is put into their bodies. The paradox is that the U.S. community blood supply is already among the safest in the world, the product of decades of evidence-based practice, universal donor screening, and rigorous infectious disease testing. HB2166 does not fix a broken system. Instead, it risks undermining one that already functions safely and effectively, which is precisely why this legislation merits attention in domains beyond the blood bank. The COVID-19 pandemic revived direct donation requests, this time driven primarily by unfounded fears that messenger RNA vaccines contaminate the blood supply. Demands for blood from unvaccinated donors have delayed time-sensitive transfusions, consumed scarce blood bank resources, and complicated perioperative planning. Directed donors have been shown to have higher rates of infectious disease markers, and such practices carry well-described risks for both recipients and donors. What is emerging is not an expansion of evidence-based patient rights, but a distortion of them. HB2166 transforms misinformation-driven preferences into enforceable medical policy. Substandard generic drugs, threats to patient safety and national security. A perspective by Kevin Shulman from Stanford University, California, and Arthur Kellerman from Emory University, Atlanta. Generic drugs account for more than 90% of prescriptions filled in the United States. The first paragraph on the homepage of the Office of Generic Drugs at the Food and Drug Administration asserts that FDA-approved generic drugs have the same high quality, strength, purity, and stability as brand-name drugs. On the strength of this assurance, America's doctors, pharmacists, and patients assume that every version of a generic drug is equally safe. But the FDA does not routinely test generic drug products, either on the market or during quality inspections of manufacturing plants. Five actions could leverage market forces to ensure drug safety in the United States. The first is acknowledging the problem. The FDA should stop claiming that all generic drugs sold in the United States are equally safe and effective. It cannot verify this claim without product testing. Second, to compensate, the FDA can encourage testing of generic drug quality by independent ISO-accredited laboratories. Third, federal agencies, including the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, could purchase drugs on the basis of best value rather than lowest cost. Fourth, quality scores could be made transparent to consumers. And fifth, the U.S. government should oversee an effort to rebuild America's capacity to manufacture generic drugs. Most generic drugs are safe, but a troubling minority are not. Testing finished drugs, signing green, that is, having no quality concern, manufacturers to long-term contracts, and sharing quality scores with the public would help realign market forces to improve safety. Shock Not Advised, a perspective by Elizabeth Rourke from Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston. On an Air France flight, Dr. Rourke hears an announcement in French requesting that anyone on the plane with medical expertise notify the cabin crew because there is a passenger who requires medical assistance. She has feared this scenario, but she stands up and tells the nearest flight attendant that she is a doctor. The flight attendant points to a seat two rows behind Dr. Rourke's. The man's body is tilted sideways across the person next to him, and his mouth is open. Dr. Rourke thinks he's dead. The flight attendant says, "Do you have your card?" She wants proof that Dr. Rourke is actually a doctor. Dr. Rourke never got a new wallet card the last time she renewed her medical license, and the flight attendant rejects the university ID Dr. Rourke presents. In the meantime, the man has been moved to a small open area in front of a row of bulkhead seats. Dr. Rourke asks another flight attendant, "Can I take his pulse?" And she says yes. Dr. Rourke touches his wrist, and it's very, very cold. He has no pulse, and she checks his carotid and can't feel anything there either. His chest isn't moving at all. She does a vigorous sternal rub with no effect. A man who says he is a volunteer EMT has a pulse oximeter. They put it on the man's finger, and it registers nothing. Dr. Rourke asks, "Is there a defibrillator?" the flight crew commences a long process of chest compressions. Periodically, the defibrillator cycles and advises against shock. Another man appears and says that he is an internist and he has a medical license card. He says they should give some epi. To their credit, the Air France flight crew produces a medical kit that includes vials of epinephrine, a syringe, and a needle. The doctor fastens the needle to the syringe and draws up the epi, and then he sticks the needle into the man's chest. Nothing happens. When they land in the United States, vehicles with flashing lights are awaiting their plane. For the rest of the week, Dr. Rourke dreams about the man every day in the early morning. She wakes with the overwhelming sensation that there's something more she needs to do, and she is haunted by questions about how the man wound up on their flight. In our images in clinical medicine, a 60-year-old woman with follicular lymphoma was evaluated for swelling and proteinuria that had persisted for 2 weeks. The patient's plasma was clear at 37 degrees centigrade, but turbid at 4 degrees centigrade, a sign of temperature-dependent precipitation of cryoglobulins. A kidney biopsy was performed and a diagnosis of type 1, that is, monoclonal immunoglobulin-related cryoglobulinemia, resulting in membranoproliferative glomerulonephritis, was made. In another image, a 30-year-old man who worked as an agricultural laborer presented with a 2-year history of skin lesions on his right foot. Examination was notable for swelling of the right foot with overlying ulcerated nodules. A diagnosis of mycetoma, also known as Madura foot, was made. Mycetoma is a chronic infection that may be caused by bacteria, actinomycetoma, or fungi, eumycetoma, and most commonly occurs in persons residing in tropical and subtropical climates who are frequently exposed to soil. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.